give a traditional basis for this new theory. The Kabbalah had all of these various different structures, which in principle may not have required any attachment to traditional doctrines. But since, by their very nature, they were quite drastically different from traditional doctrines, the first step was somehow or other to make them appear within the framework of the existing sanctified literature.
This structure come out of, I mean, so you're saying that these individual mitzvot were attached to a pre-existing mystical structure that developed independent of them. That these didn't come out of an attempt to explain the mitzvot.
That's exactly the point.
So where did they come from? From some other theology or from
the question is you're asking me a separate question. Where did the Kabbalah come from? So we've discussed this to the extent of my limited capabilities in the first shiur.
Sorry.
That there was this conflict between the traditional religion and Greek philosophy, which there were these encounters that came at various times in history, but one of the drastic periods was starting with Rav Sa'adya Gaon in perhaps in the 10th century, and then especially in the 11th and 12th centuries, in which there was no satisfactory resolution. That is, on the one hand, the naive, I don't want to use any pejorative word here, but the simple, straightforward belief in the personal God, practically anthropomorphic, someone whom you could talk to, like Avraham Avinu talked to God, as we read in these parshiyot that we're reading now in the Torah, came in conflict with the notion of the abstract definition of God as posited by the Greek philosophers, whether it's Plato or Plotinus or whatever. And neither of these particular sides of the coin is satisfactory. To a sophisticated person, it's very hard to believe that God is a person like I'm a person or you're a person. And on the other hand, to a religious person, to think of God the way Maimonides thought of God, namely as the system of natural laws in the universe, or some ultimate will, or something completely without attributes, to whom a person couldn't really have any direct communication, that your sole communication with God was through meditation and appreciating God, but the notion of a petitionary prayer is sort of meaningless within this context, offers very little in the way of satisfaction to a person who has religious needs, especially in times of crisis. So that neither side of this conflict between philosophy and religion had a satisfactory outcome. And somehow or other, this small group of Kabbalists thought that they had resolved the problem by reintroducing into Judaism myth and magic and theurgy, things which, in some sense, had been eliminated in the course of traditional Judaism. In the handout that I gave last time, I just gave you two things to read. One was Gedalia Alon's description of the world outlook of the sages, and the other was Professor Goitein's description of the everyday life of the typical religious Jew in Egypt, and you can see that they represented the form of Judaism, which is something that I sort of was familiar with growing up in the Lower East Side of New York in the 1930s and 1940s. Namely, you have a belief in God, but you don't take too seriously all of these conflicts between science and religion, and you don't probe too hard into the theological consequences of this, that, or the other. By probing too hard into these questions, the issue of faith versus philosophy became intermingled, and the Kabbalists thought that they had resolved this by reintroducing theurgy and a complicated structure of the Godhead. And the question then became how to anchor this within traditional Judaism. And what Professor Katz is saying, he's not saying this was a deliberate attempt, that this was some sort of a 400-year plot for the takeover of the Jewish religion by mysticism, but what he's saying is that these people who believed in this structure which they had created were able to express themselves within the Jewish tradition only in respect to those mitzvot which already had agadot attached to them, which were of a mystical, in quotation mark, character, at least whose simple-minded explanations seem to indicate some kind of a mystical attachment. So that was stage one in a process, Professor Katz is saying. The next person that he discusses is, he mentions the Raiva, who is a Kabbalist, but that was his secondary activity. He was principally, of course, a great halakhic authority. But his son, Rabbi Isaac the Blind, was a leader in the public Kabbalistic school. And the next issue that he discusses is, in fact, a problem of a halakhic character having to do with the nusach hatfilah or the nusach of Birchat HaMazon. And the issue was whether or not we mention King David's name in the Bonei Yerushalayim. Do we say Baruch Atah Hashem Elokei David uBonei Yerushalayim or not? Right. In the Yerushalmi, for example, it says, on the question of Bonei Yerushalayim, our Rabban Banu Latalbiyot Kel should call up Yerushalayim Palalinanav, Bebracha, Bekriyat Shema, or Betfilah, Bebracha Bonei Yerushalayim, Betfilah, Elokei David uBonei Yerushalayim. So the Talmud in Yerushalmi mentions three different forms of the where we mention Jerusalem in our prayers, and in one of them, in the Shmona Esrei, the Yerushalmi mentions that we say, contrary to our current practice, we say Elokei David uBonei Yerushalayim. Okay, this is Yerushalmi. This is Brachot Perek Daled. In my printout it says Daf Chet Amud Gimel, but that's the, I have it on the computer, so I'm just reading you the printout. Okay, similarly, in Yerushalmi in Rosh Hashanah, according to the computer, it's Daf Nun Tet Amud Gimel, but I don't know.
When you say the Krova at some Purim, it does look for the Yerushalayim to the bride. It's one bracha. It's a machshavah of the father of the Yerushalayim.
Right.
So it is one.
Well, we have a separate bracha for David. A semachdavid of the chatzmiach, etc., etc. Just that in the Chatimah it says matzmiach karen Yeshua, what have you.
But in the... that originally it...
But this is a conflict between the Bavli and the Yerushalayim. In the Bavli we have a separate bracha for David and a separate bracha for Yerushalayim. And in Yerushalmi, they combine the two, okay? So it says again, in Rabbi Bava Shem, Rabbi Abba Bar Yomir, B'tfilah Hu Omer, Elokei David uBnei Yerushalayim. B'Navi Hu Omer, Elokei David Matzmiach Yeshua. So in...
So what do they add to make up the 18th?
Do they have a different... I don't know. Okay. All right?
So that was the 18th, bro. That's why it was here.
Our Talmud, our Gemara and Sanhedrin rejects this idea and sort of has a slightly critical attitude towards David HaMelech, more than the Bavli. It says, Omar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, this is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, La'olam al yavi adam atzmo yidei nisayon. A person should never put himself in a stressful situation where he's put to the test. Sharei David Melech Yisrael hevi atzmo lidei nisayon v'nichshal. King David allowed himself to be placed in temptation and failed. Amar l'panav, Ribono shel olam, v'nei ma'omrim Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, Ein Omrim Elokei David. Why don't they mention my name along with the three patriarchs at the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei? Amar Inhu Minsuli V'at Lo Minsuli. They passed the test, but you didn't pass the test. Right. So therefore, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says that we don't mention King David's name in our tefillah because he didn't pass the test the way the others passed the test.
What about Moshe?
He didn't ask for this. So the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, has a slightly critical attitude towards King David because of his sexual transgressions. I don't need to mention any. Okay. Let's read Professor Katz. On this issue. So his page, which is 18 on the top, so he's now talking about Isaac the Blood. A tradition that came to us through various channels attaches to Rabbi Isaac the Blind a change in the Musachat Tfilah. He was in the Provence, he was the son of the Raiva. Right? The famous Raiva, the Yamantin. Right. According to one tradition, this change was in the Musachat Tfilah, that in the Bracha, we say, Elokei David Uvamei Yerushalayim, and according to another tradition, it was a change in Birchat HaMazon. We say instead of Bonei Yerushalayim or Bonei Barachamav Yerushalayim, they would say, according to Rabbi Isaac the Blind, Elokei David Uvamei Yerushalayim. Okay. Whether the Bracha of Yerushalayim applies to the Shemoneh Esrei or Birchat HaMilim, and either one or the other, it was Elokei David Uvanei Yerushalayim. This was the form of the bracha, the chatimah of the bracha, that was present in Eretz Yisrael in the tefillah of the Shemoneh Esrei, but not in Birchat HaMazon. It's mentioned in the Yerushalmi and in Rosh Hashanah, and it's brought in the Agada that is cited in the name of Yerushalmi in the book of the Sefer of the Eshkol by the grandfather of Rabbi Isaac the Blind. The Talmud Bavli recognized this nuska, but rejected it, as is hinted in the Agada in Sanhedrin that we just mentioned. That David wanted to have his name mentioned in the Tefillah, just as the names of the patriarchs were mentioned, but did not receive a favorable response. But we know of an attempt to compromise between these different opinions and to establish the Nusach of Yerushalmi, even according to the Bavli, according to Rav Moshe ben Yontov of London, he testified that his father, when he davened and said the Birchat Yerushalayim in the Shemoneh Esrei, he said, Elokei David Uvanei Yerushalayim, and he, Rav Moshe of London, followed him. The thought of these various rabbanim, scholars, moved in the traditional logical halachic path. Even though there may have been a hidden reason to make them want to give King David a symbolic status equal to that of the patriarchs, which, according to the simple interpretation of the Babylonian Talmud, he was deprived of. But there is no doubt that the purpose of the acceptance of this Musaf by Rabbi Isaac the Blind derived from considerations which were purely within the framework of the Kabbalah. All of our sources which deal with this question give this interpretation, because they say, Ha'avot hein hein ha-merkabah. The fathers are the patriarchs, stand for the chariot, for the various portions of the of God's realm. Okay, Heskel's chariot. According to the words of the Medrash and according to the interpretation of the Kabbalah, the patriarchs symbolize the three sphirot, Chesed, Gvurah, and Tiferet, three sphirot, three attributes of God, three of the sphirot amongst the ten sphirot, and that's their, that's the meaning of their identification with the Merkabah. In other words, the assertion, the purely Agadistic interpretation that the forefathers represent the Merkabah, which of course has a very simple and beautiful allegorical meaning, namely that God's rule throughout our history was symbolized by our forefathers, by the patriarchs, and or that God's rule in this world was through his influence via the patriarchs. But remember, according to the Kabbalah, everything has to have an interpretation of some balance of power within the divine realm, and therefore their interpretation of the statement that the Merkabah is the forefathers means that each of the patriarchs stands for one of the Sfirot, and they specifically identified Abraham with Chesed and Yitzhak with Gevurah and Yaakov with Tiferet, but they're in trouble because they should have four. After all, a chariot has four wheels, and therefore there should be something standing for the fourth.
About the modern
Well, Chesed is, Gvurah is a female sphira, but at any rate, Chesed, Gvurah, and Tiferet, all right? But the number of the Merkavot in the Sefer Yechezkel is four. And therefore, David should have been the fourth bearer of the chariot, which has to do with the Sfira of Malchut. Therefore, within their symbolic construction, something was missing. And if within the prayer the fourth chariot is missing from the collection, it would appear in the eyes of the Kabbalist as a insult to the structure of this Merkabah. Therefore, by mentioning King David in the prayers, either in the Bnei Yerushalayim in the davening or the Bnei Yerushalayim in the benching, one or the other, Isaac the blind fixed something that was missing. So here is a straightforward situation where purely Kabbalistic interpretation of a allegorical Agadic statement that the patriarchs were God's chariot on this earth, which I can explain in a beautiful and purely symbolic and historical framework, was interpreted backwards to mean that every time we see the name Abraham, we are really supposed to think of the Sfira of Chesed, the divine attribute of expansiveness, and every time we see the name Isaac, we're supposed to think of Gevurah, which is the divine attribute of strictness, and whenever we see the name Yaakov, we're supposed to think of the divine attribute of Tiferet, which is some kind of a compromise between these two attributes, and what's missing is the attribute of Malchut, which is the effective implementation of these divine attributes in that aspect of the Godhead which rules the world. So there's this entire mystical Kabbalistic interpretation, which, according to the way we normally daven, we're missing, because we don't say Elokei David. Yeah. Therefore, says Rabbi Isaac the Blind, that we have to fix the situation and adopt the Nusach of the Yerushalmi as opposed to the Nusach of the Baal.
So Rabbi Yitzchak, the chariot was dragging.
Right,
but
the way we daven it.
He had a remedy, so
he remedied it. And he remedied it by changing the nusach of the tefillah.
That's the fourth wheel of the fourth chariot. Well, that's the how many spokes.
So he did the Emes, the Yaakov, that's the Yaakov. The Yaakov was Emes.
Okay. All right. So here is a, you asked last time for some more examples of how the Kabbalistic approach was actually going to change the halakha. Of course, the classical halakhists were furious at the idea of, of course, this particular change did not become effective. Rabbi Shai Detrani really rebuked anyone who said it was an ignoramus who tries to add Elokei David Ubanei Yerushalayim to our prayer, precisely because, whereas the Yerushalmi didn't have a bracha for David, they didn't have Tzemach David Al-Tachov, but we do, and therefore it makes no sense for us to make a double mention of King David in the tefillah. But, and therefore, according to Professor Katz, those who did not want to have Rabbi Isaac the Blind be thought of as an ignoramus when it came, as those who wanted to add Elokei David were accused of by Rabbi Shai Detrani, had him change the nusach in the benching and not the nusach in the tefillah. But in any event, here is a typical situation in which some purely speculative, magical reinterpretation of the plain meaning of the words is read into the text, then is read into a midrash, and then is used in order to effect a change, which in this particular case didn't take place within the framework of the davening. Okay, we'll come across examples of changes which did actually take place later on. Okay. Now, let's move on to Professor Katz's analysis of Ezra of Jerome. Okay. So this is the next generation of the Kabbalists, and we have the main text of the Ezra of Girona is something which is printed in Professor Chevelle's, Rabbi Chevelle's book of the Kitvei HaRamban, as the Perush of the Ramban on Shir HaShirim in and the appendix, the list of the Tariyat Mitzvot. But as we know, that this was not written by the Ramban, but rather written by Ezra of Girona. And his next generation. So this is in the 13th century, 14th, 13th century. Okay. He has this list of the Tariyat Mitzvot. It's Ezra of Girona, but attributed to the Ramban. But we know who, it's not the Ramban, so let's give the correct attribution. He lists all of the Tariyat Mitzvot, and he's not particularly fussy about this list of Tariyat Mitzvot. In fact, the list of the Tariyat Mitzvot is identical to the Rambam's list of the Tariyat Mitzvot. Remember that there was always some debate amongst the Rishonim, since the Gemara in Makot says that there are Tariyat Mitzvot, the issue was, what are they? The Rambam had his list, which was different from the previous list of the Smad, for example. The Ramban disagreed with some of the Rambam's attributions. And then the Rambam himself has an abbreviated version of his list, written as part of the Arach HaZakah. So that's not really Rambam's full list, but rather Rambam's own abbreviation. And Ezra of Girona, in giving his reasons for the mitzvot, decides that he's going, tells us that he's now going to explain those reasons for the mitzvot which are not specifically listed in the Torah. In other words, if you have a mitzvah which is given a reason in the Torah, then you don't need a Kabbalistic interpretation for its reason. But if there are certain mitzvot which are whose reasons are not listed, then in his introduction, Ezra of Girona says that he's going to explain to you what the true meaning of this mitzvot are, and of course he's going to give the Kabbalistic interpretation. In fact, he doesn't carry out that program. So, and in fact, he also gives, amongst the various reasons, not only Kabbalistic reasons. He gives some which are ethical, and some of them philosophical, and some of them are allegorical. There are two main points which Professor Katz makes here, and that is that what is missing from Ezra of Girona's explanations is, first of all, he isn't consistent. That is, he manages to give different types of explanations, but he doesn't give different layers of explanation. When we get to the Ramban, we will find that the Ramban has introduced the notion that you have the superficial, obvious explanation, and then he will frequently add the al derech ha'emet, the true meaning of this, is the Kabbalistic meaning, and that will be given an entirely different interpretation. So for the Ramban, who comes after Ezra of Girona, one has a later notion, namely that there are various different levels of interpretation of the Bible. One is the straightforward reading of the Bible, and the other is an entirely different, hidden, mystical meaning of the Bible. Like the codes. I'm glad you brought that up. I did not bring that up. But since you brought it up, we might as well discuss it. I mean, this is exactly, it's very, very interesting to actually see such a development taking place in our own time. That is, one now has the new notion that the Bible is to be read. You can read it if you like with the Perush Rashi or even the Perush of the Ramban, but on the other hand, you can read it with the aid of a computer and find all of these hidden mystical and hidden meanings and codes planted in there. I mean, after all, what is this? Is this something which is 10 or 15 years old? I think one can precisely date it that it couldn't have occurred in this time before the invention of the computer, right? I mean, like that famous statement that the Napoleon complex didn't exist in the 17th century.
Weissmandl.
Why are you blaming former Rabbi Weissmandl? He did nothing. He's been completely misquoted out of context here. This is the fact that what has happened in our own time, within the time framework of 10 years, and I've been present watching this happen. One has a bunch of Meshugayim thinking that they can find the hidden secrets in the Bible because God planted all of these secrets which could only be decoded by means of a computer. Mm-hmm. They use these things to predict the future. Then they say, well, maybe they didn't really use these things to predict the future, but only to predict the past. This is not quite clear because, in fact, we have quite a bit of evidence that they used.
Who's the they? This group of
my colleagues.
Right, these Karen. These Meshugayim. Okay.
He said we don't want to beat Kajara.
I know that, but you were referring to this set of people.
Right. Now, what has happened with this set of people? This an organization, namely Eisha Tova, which the Young Israel, I understand, is a branch now, has taken over this and really threatened anyone who dares to disagree with it. They quote various famous Russian yeshiva. I don't know whether these quotes are correct or not, but they certainly are supporting it. There's now been a statement issued by the great Torah scholars, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's son, an edict, which says that anyone who dares to question this, Alav Nitenet Hadin, so that, in fact, this has now become not accepted, but it's become part and parcel of the deemed with a holy authority. Now, of course, the next stage is not going to be merely that they're going to predict the future, but they will also once they come to empowered, will of course also be able to read the true halachot, as it says in the Bible. I mean, those rabbanim who have decided that it's okay to, not only okay to condone this, but who actually presented this as the complete antidote to all of science's threatening. I mean, after all, this arose also on the part of the fact that the people that were involved here want to have an antidote to science. The senior editor of Newsweek, whom I tried to dissuade, in that case successfully, of publishing a long article on it, said that science has gone too far. We need some kind of a remedy to science, and this is it. But of course, it's a very dangerous sword, because pretty soon, those people who have this direct line to God via the codes will start to tell you how the halacha is supposed to be performed also. It's not as if this is completely isolated from behavior. So here we see, in the course of a very short amount of time, how a small group, and it's a small group phenomenon, a small group of people were able to communicate with one another, influence one another, and then mount a massive publicity campaign which has established something which probably won't go away for hundreds of years. And therefore, it's no surprise that a similar phenomenon could take place in the 11th or 12th century. If you have a visible example.
You don't quite understand the numbers.
All right. At any event, I thought I would cover all of Professor Katz's article tonight, but there are some important points that he makes that we'll have to postpone until next week. But then I also want to begin on, it won't take us the whole time, and those of you who have a copy of this book can read the first chapter, which has to do with the influence of the Zohar on Halakhic development.